Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. And today, we're going to begin with a story about Fred and Lena Meyer. And they have left the world a little better than what they found. The supermarket chain Meyer has nearly 250 stores operating in Michigan and the Midwest. While the business's success is notable, also significant are second generation owners, Fred and Lena Meyer. The ripples of their philanthropic pursuits can be felt across Michigan and elsewhere today. Since the Meyer name is already on more than a few buildings, the family has sometimes resisted the naming opportunities that would come with substantial gifts or use such occasions to honor others. Still, the name has a way of popping up. For example, Fred and Lena were regular theater goers at the Grand Rapids Civic Theater. And it worried Fred that the old majestic movie house had trouble accommodating patrons who needed a more barrier-free environment. Renovating the theater became a pet project. And in 2006, the newly refurbished space was christened the Meyer Majestic Theater. Evidence of Fred and Lena Meyer's influence can be found throughout Western Michigan. At Grand Valley State University in Allendale, the Frederick Meyer Honors College encourages undergraduate achievement, as does the campus Fred Meyer Center for Writing and Michigan Authors. Other components of regional culture bear the Meyer footprint too. From the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Library and Museum to Millennium Park to the Fred Meyer Salt Lake Bog Nature Preserve to the whale skeleton on display at the Grand Rapids Public Museum. While Grand Rapids in particular has benefited from the Meyer family's retail enterprise, which moved there in 1951, other communities across the state have felt its influence as well. Muskegon Community College has the Hendrick Meyer Library, and the little town of Lakeview, Lena Rader Meyer's birthplace, has summer concerts in Rader Park. Supporting institutions and events has always been a part of the Meyer family's and company's culture, starting with bidding on 4-H livestock at the Mount Calm County Fair. Today, that tradition continues as the company sponsors scoreboards, festivals, and community organizations throughout the 6 states in which its stores are located. With a heritage in food, Fred and Lena's company makes its biggest commitment to the fight against hunger in the communities it serves. Simply Give is not only the name of the Meyer program that emphasizes reducing hunger, but also it is an expression of the Meyer family's philosophy. Furthermore, Fred enthusiastically supported a free antibiotics program through the Meyer that filled its 50 millionth prescription this year. The Meyers have been involved in countless undertakings in education, social services, and the arts. But any accounting for the couple's charitable efforts would be remiss not to focus on a project on the east side of Grand Rapids that grew from the hopes of the local horticultural society to create a botanical garden. Lena Meyer loved flowers. She was reluctant to move into a senior citizen apartment because it would mean giving up her rose garden. Fred's guiding philosophy was always rooted in an expression of his mother's. His mother, Gesine Meyer, was a plain-spoken and progressive Dutch immigrant with an exceedingly thrifty lifestyle. But she and Hendrik both came from the Netherlands, a place where art mattered, even if it was not financially well off. Fred would always remember Gesine saying, "The eye needs something too." The something that the eye required was often part of the natural world. On the bike trails that Fred campaigned for and funded across the state, or in the forests and parklands that he helped preserve. When the Horticultural Society of Kent County in Michigan approached him for help with its campaign to create a garden, Fred Meyer knew that such an undertaking could be an important source of delight for Lena and for countless others as well. The couple's newfound goal of establishing a botanical garden converged with another of their interests. Every summer, Fred and Lena attended the annual Danish festival in Greenville, Michigan. And there, they met Marshall Fredericks, the Danish consul for Michigan, and notable Cranbrook sculptor. As Fred and Marshall became good friends, the former quietly began acquiring works by the artist. Fred Meyer had no intention of amassing for personal use what would become the largest collection of Frederick's bronze sculptures. Kent County was willing to give the Horticultural Society some parkland north of Grand Rapids. And on that land, there was ample space for a greenhouse and for gardens, though the acreage was relatively remote from the city. While continuing his support for the establishment of the botanical garden, Fred, almost in passing, remarked that such a space might be a good place for the sculptures, were it in a more convenient and inviting location. Betsy Bohr of the Horticultural Society had a suggestion and ultimately a solution. Meyer owned property on East Beltline Avenue and intended to build a new store there, but he had been unsuccessful in obtaining commercial zoning. Bohr wondered if Meyer would donate the property. At first, Meyer was hesitant at the idea of giving up more than 100 valuable acres in a prime Grand Rapids location. But he quickly recognized the potential of such a large parcel, which was so convenient to the city. Plus, now he had a place to install his collection of sculptures. Money was raised for a cultural destination that few of its early supporters could readily envision. In 1995, the Frederick Meyer Gardens and Sculpture Park opened its doors. In subsequent years, Fred entrusted a volunteer sculpture committee at the Meyer Gardens to begin building one of the world's great collections of contemporary sculpture. As the institution grew into Michigan's second most visited tourist destination, Lena's fondness for Japanese gardens found expression in the DeVos Japanese Garden, which was to be completed after Fred's death. Expansion at the gardens continues even today in a way that would have gratified its founder's vision for what had once been derided as Freddy's Farm. Fred and Lena Meyer's community initiatives traditionally have had a way of spreading. 30 years ago, Fred was approached by Civic Letters in Montcalm County to help turn a few miles of abandoned railroad right-of-way into bicycle trails. Some farmers along the route were wary of having public access to lands that were bordering their fields. But Meyer testified on behalf of the project and helped sell the idea to skeptical neighbors, explaining that the benefits of biking trails outweighed their concerns. Well, one trail led to another, and soon the Fred Meyer White Pine Trail ran north out of Grand Rapids. And today, those original Montcalm County trails have been augmented by approximately 300 miles of biking paths that have made Michigan a national leader in the Rails to Trails movement. Early on, Fred had been an advocate for the urban renewal movement that reshaped downtown Grand Rapids. Though in hindsight, he came to wonder about the removal of some of the city's prime examples of Victorian architecture. But he also had a passion for history and was eager to preserve and to help restore iconic buildings, including the Grand Rapids Public Library. If you looked at the December 2019 issue of Smithsonian Magazine, you would have found an article entitled In the American Grain, subtitled Searching for the Essence of the Prickly, Brilliant, Deeply Influential Frank Lloyd Wright. And so, here we go. About Frank Lloyd Wright. I may tell you more than you want to hear, but he's an extremely interesting individual and certainly a huge influence on architecture. Frank Lloyd Wright, the greatest architect this country has yet produced, was born 2 years after the end of the Civil War, and died not quite 2 years after the launch of Sputnik. 91 years and 10 months on the Earth. in his cape and pork pie hat and those goofy pants, almost like pantaloons, that were pegged at the ankles. He strutted through our national imagination for something like a 7-decade career. His work has been built over 3 centuries, the 19th, the 20th, and the 21st. In his 72-year career as an architect and egotist, Wright managed to design more than 1,100 things, a staggering number by any artistic measurement. There were churches, schools, offices, banks, museums, hotels, medical clinics, and automobile showrooms, a synagogue, a mile-high skyscraper, and one exotic-looking Phillips 66 gas station in Cloquet, Minnesota. Overwhelmingly, though, they were houses, shelters for mankind, and by that fact alone, there is something slyly to be said about his fundamental decency as a human being. By no means did all of it get built. Not quite half of all of his drawings and designs and studies were realized. And a little more than 400 still come magically out of the American ground looking for the light. Falling Water near Pittsburgh. The Guggenheim Museum on Fifth Avenue. The Johnson Wax Building in Racine, Wisconsin. University Temple in Oak Park, Illinois. Robie House on the campus of the University of Chicago. These are just a few of the masterworks. One of Wright's nearly lifelong dictums was that his buildings were like shrubs and trees, growing upward, in effect, from the inside out, emerging spanking wet and blinking their eyes to the world. It was all part of his gospel of organic architecture, even if his definitions of that concept were always shifting around, like verbal tectonic plates. And sometimes they seemed to mystify even him. It was as if he knew what he meant, or at least felt, even if you didn't know, and even if in some ultimate spiritual and intellectual sense, he didn't really know either. He didn't need to know. He just needed to conceive the thing, draw the thing, and make the thing. The thing had simply shaken itself out of my sleeve, the old shaman used to say, ever his own best publicist. Shelters for mankind, from the almost impossibly grand to the utilitarian, bare and spare and functional, and all the more beautiful for such simplicity and environmental purity. No matter what else he did with the design of a house in his nearly 3/4 of a century as a revolutionary architect, whether hanging it on the lip of a waterfall in Pennsylvania or sticking it mirage-like in the middle of a desert in Arizona, he was out to break the box, to destroy forever those tight, draped, dark, horsehair, closed-off Victorian rooms of our 19th century forebears. He wanted to let light in, and space in, air in, life in. And he did so radically. Evangelically, it was a way of thinking and feeling he never let go of. He did it initially and most radically in his prairie houses in and around the turn of the century, which alone are enough to have made him immortal. The esteemed contemporary architecture critic, Paul Goldberger, once put it this way in regard to Wright. He said, he really did feel that America, as this new democratic country, needed a new architectural expression that was horizontal, open in plan, open across the landscape, a sense somehow that it was connecting to that great open American land. He saw that American landscape, the openness of it, the sense that it was always moving across the land, pushing westward. As we near the end of today's program, it seems appropriate to talk about a couple of subjects that we use perhaps all the time, but we don't know the origin of. And that is, what was the origin of zip codes? The U.S. Postal Service introduced the Zone Improvement Plan, zip code, in 1963. Nationwide system mechanized more of the work of mail sorting, which had previously been done by hand. The idea dates to 1944, when Postal Inspector Robert Moon proposed adding a three-digit code to addresses. The first number referred to a region, and the next two, a mailing processing center. 2 decades later, after mail volumes had grown exponentially, Postmaster J. Edward Day adopted a version of this plan and added a fourth and fifth digit designating a specific post office. The zip code has been expanded twice. 4 additional numbers indicate what side of the street or even hallway the destination is on. 2 more numbers sequence the carrier route that will be taken. This makes our mailing much more efficient than it was back in the 1940s. And then, why is the Republican Party represented by an elephant and the Democrat Party by a donkey? Well, President Andrew Jackson was supported by the Democrats in 1828, and he earned the name Jackass for his stubbornness. The image stuck to the Democrats and took off after the Civil War, when they were seen as the defeated party that wouldn't accept its loss. Around the same time, cartoonist Thomas Nast started drawing a stumbling elephant to represent the Republican Party. Once united by its abolitionist goal, but struggling in the post-war years. Originally somewhat insulting, both symbols were embraced in the early 20th century, and that's why the Republican Party is represented by the elephant and the Democratic Party by a donkey. Did you know that mosquitoes actually serve a purpose. While they can seem pointless and purely irritating to us humans, mosquitoes do play a substantial role in the ecosystem. They form an important source of biomass in the food chain, serving as food for fish as larvae, and for birds, bats, frogs, and adult flies. And some species are important pollinators. Mosquitoes don't deserve the bad rap that they are getting. And now, my friends, looks like we're at the end of today's program. I hope it's been interesting for you. And I want to say until next time, this is Dan Dillman asking you to be safe out there. Take care. Wear your mask. And please, social distance. It helps us all. Have a good day, my friends. It's been a pleasure to serve you today. Tune in to a little of this, a little of that. I'll be waiting there to give you another program next time. Good day.